Thank you for being here. How many of you are ready to learn about our microbiome and what can happen when we reduce the carbs in our diet? I just want to thank you also for being here. It's been a really interesting year for me, just to speak honestly, and I was feeling really uninspired. I showed up here yesterday after having a few simple conversations with a few of you. I feel so much better. I'm re-energized. I'm ready to tackle my mission, and I feel so much better. So thank you for being a part of this community and just the tiny little words of kindness that we have shared between us. Okay, so I'm really excited and I'm really grateful to be here because I'm going to bring up some topics that might be controversial. And I like to do that, and I like to do that in this context so that we can have a real conversation and see how we can help our clients. I need this thing. The slides you have access to, if I say something that's not on the slides, I promise to try to tell you to write it down. That much I can do. And I'm going to talk really fast so that at the end we can talk about your questions. I hope that's all right. So we're going to cover some specific bacteria that can be reduced on a ketogenic type or a low-carb diet, any diet that's designed not to spike your blood sugars. We're going to talk about carbohydrates, some different types of carbohydrates, short chain, medium chain, long chain, what they are, who they feed, where they go in our gut, why. We're going to talk about FODMAPs versus resistant starch, what these are, how they're broken down, and we're going to talk about some pros and cons of supplementing with resistant starch. Has anybody heard about resistant starch? Yeah, has anybody heard about this potato starch, like eat potato starch? Yeah, okay, sweet. Thank you. okay, we're going to talk about how to feed your gut bugs without spiking your blood sugar. We're going to talk about how to feed the bacteria that specifically support reducing insulin resistance or even reversing it. And we're going to talk about specific probiotics that you can use with your clients to help when maybe food isn't enough or when they can't tolerate certain foods. Okay. So before we get into the challenges that we're going to work through together, I want to talk about some of the benefits of a ketogenic or a low-carb, any kind of low-carbohydrate diet to the microbiome. Firstly, quite often, it starves small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Quite often, if you have a client who's going on like any kind of keto, especially like this plant-based type keto, you'll find that they get less symptoms like gas and bloating after eating. And a lot of that is because you're cutting out glucose. You're cutting out glucose for them. And it's a really important distinction to remember that these small intestine bacteria want to eat glucose. They don't want to eat FODMAPs. They want to eat glucose. They can eat FODMAPs because we're not able to absorb them very well. And so the FODMAPs are kind of left over in the gut. And yeah, okay, so given the option, they'll break those down into glucose that they can then use. But they prefer glucose, straight up. So if you're drinking sugar water, you're feeding your small intestinal bacteria. That's just what's happening. And so actually the gold standard of SIBO testing in Europe for a long time has been a glucose test, where we have a lactulose test, they have a glucose test. And the results are very, very similar to our testing over here. So cutting out those simple sugars really can benefit the small intestinal environment. So that's the first thing that's awesome. We're starving candida, also awesome, and other yeasts and fungi, right? It's not just candida. When I say candida, I mean any kind of yeast that is not helpful in our gut and in our bodies. Just because we're starving candida doesn't mean we're getting rid of them, though. So they might still be there. The yeasts and fungi might still be there, but we're just not feeding them. So your clients might experience a great reduction in symptoms because they're not exacerbating their yeast overgrowth if that was a problem for them. So also cuts out many crappy foods, especially if you're doing the diet in a way that Dr. Rita Marie and most of us here, I think, are participating in. So if you're working with your clients in that kind of diet, you're cutting out a lot of crappy foods, non-foods, white powders that people think are foods, right? Sugar, flour, processed things, beige foods. you're cutting that out. That's beneficial, straight up. Reducing inflammation overall in the body benefits the gut, just as reducing digestive inflammation benefits the rest of the body. Anything that is setting off the inflammatory cascade just kind of makes it worse everywhere. So reducing inflammation, good times. Okay. So what's the problem? There are some bacteria that have been shown to benefit insulin resistance, reverse it, reduce it, to help us to get more sleep, to increase our melatonin, to inform our circadian rhythm. Those bacteria are not being well fed. Actually, Mike Mutzel yesterday talked about how our nervous system like enervates the gut during the daytime, right? And how we can stop eating later in the day because our gut is less active. So when the gut stops receiving so many signals to be active, it starts the bacteria, predominantly the bifido-led bacteria in the colon, actually send a signal back to us saying, hey, okay, you want me to go to sleep? You make some melatonin then. Okay, and then our bodies make melatonin. It's like it's a really cool symbiosis that goes on in there. So with a reduced bifidum and reduced bacteria that the bifidum supports, we end up with less of this kind of circadian dance that we do at the end of the day. It's really good information because even if your clients can't tolerate any food, you can help them by just giving them some bifido, which should not live in the small intestine. Okay, so increased amino acids can lead to increased ammonia and amines in the gut. And that supports the growth of bacteria like Clostridium, Shigella, E. coli, Enterobacter and Citrobacter, which have been associated with irritable bowel and inflammatory bowel diseases. So if you... Let's say you have a client who's been eating sort of really low carb for a long time. They're getting a lot of gut tests, and it keeps coming back with lots of Citrobacter. And you're like, oh, what do I do about this? And you've done all the, you know, adding the bifido. We've talked a lot about adding different probiotics to help. But we haven't really talked about feeding the probiotics or feeding our gut and feeding the amino acids, and too many of them perhaps, or feeding them the long-chain carbs and what the difference is. So that's something that we're going to have to, I think, work out for people. These bacteria are here to help us with our metabolism, but it's like one of those, like, it's like a help me help you kind of a situation. We need to help them to thrive in order to get that help from them. So specifically, we're talking about Bifidobacterium, and it's any of the species of Bifidobacterium have really similar benefits in this way. It's quite a classification of organisms. It's like saying like all the monkeys and including us, right? So there are a lot of different species of Bifido. There are less studies on them if you're just searching around than the Lactobacillus because they're just a little bit more difficult to make into probiotics and to market. And they're a lot less available, a little bit more expensive for your clients to purchase. So Bifidobacterium, we're talking about Eubacterium rectal. We're talking about Blottia and Fecali bacterium. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. It's not a pretty word. But some really exciting, we'll talk a little bit later about some of the specific benefits of these bacteria. Being anaerobic, these bacteria do not survive the shelves very well. They're not being propagated and put into capsules and sold to your clients because it just doesn't work. They would die. So most of the studies on these have been fecal transplants and a lot of them on humans as well. And a lot of them not in order to sell a product because that's not where we're at yet with those. Okay, so Bifido. How many of you have heard me talk about Bifido before? We've had conversations about Bifido? Okay, awesome. I kind of love Bifido. And right now, you know, studies show that our Bifido colonies decrease with age. And it's really hard to have a study like that without our current cultural and food context, right? So given what we're all eating and how we're all living right now, yeah, they're decreasing with age. We also know that they can help us with our metabolism. We know they can help us with our sleep. We know they can support that whole colony of short-chain fatty acid-producing bacteria. Has anybody heard of short-chain fatty acids? Yeah. Sweet. Okay. The bifidobacteria help to maintain a healthy large intestinal environment. I always call them the grandmothers of the large intestine or the conductor of the large intestinal orchestra because without them, there isn't really a stable home for those bacteria, which we can't purchase to thrive. So cool thing about Bifido is they can help us to increase our absorption of minerals, especially calcium and magnesium, and they can reduce the risk of autism, diarrhea, IBD, IBS, Crohn's, allergies, whether inhaled or ingested through food. Actually, I have a, so I'm giving you like a bunch of gifts. Were there cards on your chairs when you came in? Okay, I'll make sure that that happens later. That's okay. I'm giving you a bunch of gifts. I'm really streamlining everything I'm doing to be this friendly flora program. I have so many gifts of benefits of bacteria and little ebooks about Bifido that I've basically just put all together for you. Just makes it a lot easier and we don't have to talk about everything and write everything down. So just in case you don't get all this information, it's all in there, okay? And you don't have to write and scramble. Okay, so here's the eubacterium. They produce butyrate, which is a short-chain fatty acid. They reduce inflammation, and they protect against cognitive impairment. Again, these are studies that were done on human beings. The last two pages of this set of slides is populated with studies that you can read in full. So it's not just linking you to a blurb, but you can actually read the studies in full about these bacteria when you have time. The Blottia, which I think are really cool, because I was reading so much about them, and it seems like even in each little population or in each individual, there can be unique species, not just strains, but species of Blottia. So they seem really adaptable to me. They've been shown to reduce the risk of colorectal cancer and reduce mortality after certain surgical interventions like bone marrow transplants. Okay, and then the Faecalibacterium, protecting against Crohn's disease, producing butyrate, increasing the feeling of fullness. Can you imagine how much you could help your clients if you could help them to just feel more full, to feel more satiated? It's such a simple thing, but it matters. To reduce inflammation, again, essential. To improve insulin sensitivity. So a lot of these benefits come from short-chain fatty acids, right? And so just straight up, here are some of the most important benefits, I think, that we can receive from short-chain fatty acids in the gut. Of course, you want to have them in a certain balance, and you know you can nerd out about this, but in general, they help you feel full. They help you absorb water. They help you with your hydration. I think that's pretty cool. They protect against colon cancer and inflammatory bowel diseases, Crohn's, colitis. They decrease liver lipogenesis, and they improve insulin sensitivity. Again, the whole point of this is to improve our clients' insulin sensitivity, right? To get them off of this crazy blood sugar roller coaster. And these bacteria can help us to do it if we can find a way to support them. Okay, so just want to do a quick like journey into the world of carbohydrates. Okay, so we've got glucose, right? We absorb it really well. It makes us go all wiggy and all tired, and it makes us fat in the middle, and it does all the bad things. Okay, glucose. There are some other short-chain sugars that are less well-absorbed that can bother people in the small intestine, like fructose, lactose, maltose. Let me get into the medium-chain sugars. So these are the ones that have been, I think, vilified a little bit, the FODMAPs. We got sorbitol, xylitol, erythritol, polyols. I was going to make a list for you of all the polyols, and there's like hundreds of them. There's just so many. So there are a lot of sugars in this category, and we all have a different amount of enzymes produced in our small intestine called brush border enzymes that help us to break these down. We produce, each of us, a different spectrum of these enzymes, different ones in different quantities, and we produce different amounts of them. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it has to do with our lineage. Maybe we have adapted to be able to break down the amount of these that would naturally appear in foods we could eat from nature. I do not know. But I do know that you can't find a cup of xylitol anywhere. it's in barks of trees and maybe in some roots and some mushrooms. You're not going to be sweetening things with xylitol in nature. And I think when we eat something that tastes sweet and it doesn't spike our blood sugar, a lot of the time it's feeding our small intestinal bacteria because someone's going to eat it. Okay, some long-chain carbohydrates. So this includes fibers and fibrous things. It includes amylose and amylopectin, which are the resistant starches. It includes just pectin, chitin, lignans, soluble and insoluble fiber. So yeah, this is a big category as well. The thing about most of these long-chain carbohydrates is, yes, your bacteria still want to break them down to glucose. It's going to take them a lot longer. So depending on your client's motility, they're going to be able to, you know, get through the whole small intestine before they're broken down to the point where they can directly feed bacteria. Really, one of the key things here is resistant starch. There are a few different types of resistant starch, and there are more developing. So we keep producing these human-made resistant starches and adding new categories, right? So resistant starch, number one, is starch that would otherwise be digestible, but is like being protected somehow. It's either housed in some kind of a casing, it's like in the shell of the plant, or in some way, like it's not impossible. These are not impossible starches, they're resistant starches. So they resist being broken down, but they will eventually be broken down. So they're housed in some kind of casing, and then they get through your whole small intestine, and basically eventually they get broken down. Resistant starch type 2 is a starch that you would find in like raw things, like raw yacon root, green bananas, plantains, raw yams. Yeah, so I feel like I should mention this. You know when you eat a green banana, you know that feeling, that like, that thing? So there's kind of a dryness, there's an astringency, and like kind of a pastiness, right? So when I'm talking about resistant starches, I'm not talking about like a donut. I'm not talking about something that tastes really sweet. I'm not saying we need to add in sweet foods. There's something about that kind of starchiness that you also find in a lot of herbs, like dandelion root and burdock root. Can you relate to this weird mouth feeling that I'm telling you about? Okay. So anyway, that's resistant starch number two. Resistant starch number three is retrograde starch. And what that is, and there's a lot of information about this, and I've spent many, many times, many long time, weeding through this information. What this is resistant starch number two that has then been cooked and broken down and destroyed. And you put it in the fridge at 4 degrees Celsius or 39 Fahrenheit. I'm sorry, I did not put this in slides. I didn't think I was going to share it. 4 degrees Celsius or 39 Fahrenheit for 24 hours, okay? So resistant starch 2, destroyed by heat, put in the fridge at a certain temperature for 24 hours and gets recrystallized. Okay, so this starch gets recrystallized and that becomes resistant starch number 3. You can recook this and this will not break down. Every time you recook it, actually, you're going to get more of those resistant starches 2 turning into resistant starches 3, and you're going to end up, in the end, with overall more resistant starch. And it's so parboiled rice, which is like kind of like cooked and cooled rice, or cooked and cooled potatoes are going to have less of an effect on our blood sugar than just eating the cooked potato. But it's still not something that, you know, that I eat or that I would recommend to many people. So anyway, that's retrograde starch. Doesn't work for plantains. Doesn't work for green bananas. Doesn't work for a lot of these foods. Doesn't work for tiger nuts. So you can heat up plantains and cool them as much as you want, but you're not going to get retrograde resistant starch. So some other types of resistant starch, we've got 4, 5, and 6. They're adding them on. Resistant starch 5, interestingly, is when you fry potatoes in oil, basically. And some of the starches get bound up with the oil. That's resistant starch number 5. And then the other ones are really human-made resistant starches to add to foods. And they don't really apply very much to me. I don't recommend a lot of processed foods to my clients, and yeah, so I left them off, but you can go ahead and research that if that's of interest to you. Just water. Okay, so again, so so much time. This page of my fun slideshow is a testament to hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of trying to figure out what's real. And basically, there is nothing real. It depends on the cultivar of the plant. It depends on the soil in which it's grown. It depends on the ripeness of the fruit. Okay, so what I have here on this page, and when you keep this as a resource at home, what I have here is what I determined to be the average of all the information that I could soak up. Okay, so plantains, depending on their ripeness, might have 15, was my conservative estimate, or more grams of resistant starch per cup. And that's just the whole fruit chopped up into bits. Tiger nuts, which you're gonna see all over the place, touted as having an exceptionally high resistant starch content, my guess is 12 grams per cup. Cashews, 9 grams per cup. White beans and black beans, lentils, chickpeas, yams, cooked and cooled potatoes, cooked and cooled white rice, jicama. Finally, I was like, oh, jicama, okay, I eat that. So 3 grams per cup, right? So you might chop up a couple cups of jicama and have that, and you end up with 6 grams of resistant starch. Okay, here's the crux of the problem. The amount of resistant starch that has been shown to help our clients with their digestive health, just their digestive health. So that's to help to heal the epithelial lining, to reduce inflammation, to reduce the colon cancer risk factors, is 20 to 25 grams of resistant starch per day. So you may be sitting there going, I don't eat any of those foods, except cashews and sometimes tiger nuts and jicama, right? Is anyone doing that? Yeah. So I wanted to also share with you, why don't you eat white beans and black beans? I still don't eat them very much, but I do have a bit of a hack for this. Is it because of the phytates and the anti-nutrients? Is that the reason for anybody? I have many reasons why I don't often consume these. But one thing that I have learned is that if you pre-soak them in Lactobacillus plantarum, I know you know how to pre-soak your beans in water. You pre-soak them in water with Lactobacillus plantarum and you let them pre-ferment, you're gonna reduce the phytates extremely by a very, very, very high amount. And then if you choose to cook them and then ferment them into your yogurt or tempeh or whatever it is that you're making with those beans, it means you gotta make everything at home. But you're gonna be reducing the lectins to almost nothing and making them more digestible. One of my issues with this, when I was looking into this and just like doing the head scratch for months, is this is not a level playing field. I can't tell all my clients to go out and buy cashews. My clients don't all go to Whole Foods. My clients don't even pay me. You know, there are people who can't afford to get these foods. And I can't say that someone's health depends on their ability to go buy cashews. I just don't think that's right. So I'm just looking for solutions, and I'm hoping that together we can find some solutions to this. And it might be that, you know, those of us that are already in great health are like, oh, maybe I don't need to eat 20 to 25 grams of resistant starch. But our clients are coming to us with like myriad overlapping issues, right? Like they've got stuff going on in their gut, they've got like a history of migraines, they've got, you know, they're having menopause, like there's all sorts of things going on. And it's a matter of like, what am I gonna deal with first? How am I gonna help them the most effectively? And I think, again, Mike Mutzel, thanks for his talk. It's really given me a lot of stuff to talk about. I think he said it yesterday, basically, if you don't have the gut right, the ketogenic diet's not gonna work anyway. So you're getting clients who don't have the results that they desire. I urge you to go back and look at the gut and to look at this. So metabolically, the amount of resistant starch that has been shown to help us in that way is something more in the neighborhood of 25 to 35 grams per day. So that's even more. Okay. So some inulin-containing foods. So one of the things that I thought that might happen is, you know, you talk to your clients about these resistant starches and about prebiotics and feeding their good bugs, and then they go to the store and they buy inulin. And then they eat it, and then they feel crappy and get mad or never call you again or whatever. So inulin, while it is a prebiotic, is much more easily broken down than the resistant starches we were talking about, and so can really exacerbate gas and bloating after meals or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And so you're going to find that in chicory root, Jerusalem artichoke, jicama, yacon. I'm talking about raw yacon. So yacon syrup, not helping us here. Raw yacon, like who has raw yacon? I don't know. Garlic. Right? Again, this is a little bit of a privileged thing. I can go to the store and buy Jerusalem artichokes. I can grow yacon. I have 50 acres of farmland. Like, this isn't real for people. This isn't helping them. Anyway, but so if they're having gas and bloating, make sure they're not having the foods that have too much inulin in them. Okay, pectin-containing foods. So how many of you, when I say pectin, are thinking about apples? Yep, apples and jam. Apples and jam and grandma. Right, so maybe it's just me then. So citrus peels. So not citrus, citrus peels. And you can do things with citrus peels. Like I make myself ginger and lemon juice. I put it in the freezer so I can just like pull it out, you know. And I cut off the peels of the citrus fruit, and I dehydrate them and I powder them. I put them in my smoothies. So yeah, you can get pectin from the peels. If you're gonna go apple, you know, try green apple. There's nopal cactus or prickly pear, the little red fruits. Carrots, peas, squash, tomatoes. So pectin is another starch or long chain carbohydrate that is not easily broken down. In fact, you can like thicken your non-dairy yogurt with pectin and ferment it for like 12 hours and not have it change consistency at all, which is not the case for a lot of other thickeners. So pectin is really resistant, is gonna take at least longer than 12 hours to break down, and does increase the amount of bifidobacteria and that whole bifido colony in the large intestine. So that can be an option. And it's also cheap. But yeah, I'm really excited about amlaberry, gooseberries, or also known as amlaberry, Indian gooseberry, blackberries, elderberries, and blueberries. So yeah, you might not be able to recommend a whole bunch of blueberries or blackberries, but maybe your client can eat like 4 blueberries. I don't know. You have the keto mojo. You have the freestyle Libra. Work it out with them. Include as many of the resistant starch foods or the high pectin foods that they're able to eat without having an undesired metabolic effect. Also, if you want to include blackberries or something like that, elderberries, you can ferment them into a chutney. You can reduce their sugars, their easy sugars, because when you ferment something, the bacteria are going to eat the easy sugar first, the glucose first, right? And then they're going to start to break down the other sugars. But amlaberries, have you ever had gooseberries? Gooseberries are really sour. They're really sour. Yeah, that's not a really sugary food. I wanted to just quickly talk about some herbs that feed these bacteria and feed other bacteria in the gut. So your clients don't necessarily have the benefit of your ability to look at the big picture. Right, so I wanted to go over some of the big picture with you on these herbs. Your clients might have, you know, heartburn, and they might be taking aloe. Actually, that's another one of the gifts that I am just throwing together to give you is a book about some different herbs and their effect on digestion. So if I'm saying something that's not on the slide, it might be in there. So burdock root, chicory, calendula, nopal cactus, aloe, Jerusalem artichoke, these all are going to feed our large intestinal bacteria, the bifidobacteria, and they're all going to have some different effects. Some of them are really soothing, like the aloe. The burdock is really, it does have resistant starches and has other benefits as well. There are some different ways to prepare these. So you can find burdock root at some Asian markets. You can get it online. You can even buy it in grocery stores, just regular grocery stores sometimes. There's like an arc with how to prepare these foods in order to have them feed those large intestine bacteria. And the arc is you're good up until about 80 degrees Celsius. I did not do the conversion on that. So if someone wants to convert that to Fahrenheit, I'd be super happy. So up to 80 degrees Celsius. So somewhere between like 65 to 7 and 80 degrees Celsius, you're going to have a really great amount of accessible, digestible, resistant starch in these foods. And then once you get over 80, not so much. The issue with these herbs, and the reason why I'm bringing this up, is because it's quite common to take marshmallow root or burdock or something else and put it in a hot tea. So you're putting it in a hot tea. The carbohydrates are water-soluble, so they are going to go into the water. That's another thing for clients with SIBO. They can't have slippery elm or aloe or these things that have the medium-chain carbohydrates because they're going to feed the small intestine bacteria. It's going to be different for everybody, but that's an issue. And they might think, oh, well, it's just tea, it's just water, but those carbohydrates go into the water. So they're water soluble. So putting it in hot tea doesn't really work because then we have destroyed resistant starches. Having it in cold water in the fridge, I really don't think is enough. It does work for some of the herbs, so like marshmallow root, and you'll still get a nice demulcent thing. But I think somewhere in the middle is going to be the best for having those resistant starches if that's your goal from these herbs. Here are some other ones. I just put amla like so many times because I'm so excited that it's not a sweet food and that it can help. And there are some good studies showing it increasing the bifidobacteria. Slippery elm, marshmallow, kelp. I just can't get my finger on an exact number. I know they do help to increase these bacteria. I know that they have longer chain carbohydrates, and same with the medicinal mushrooms. There haven't been enough studies on this to know. Thank you. So probiotics. So the food aside, we're going to have a little jam session about the food and see if we can problem solve a little bit in a moment. Food aside, here are some probiotic supplements that might help. The bifidobacterium, because we can take them, and they do support that whole colony, and we are talking about feeding them, so it makes sense. Bacillus bacteria, and these are those spore-forming bacteria that can help to reduce the Clostridium and the E. coli and a lot of the small intestinal bacteria that we don't want to get out of balance, that can become out of balance when we're eating more fats and proteins and less carbohydrates. So all those ones from whatever the third slide that I was talking about, the Bacillus bacteria can help us to reduce those. And Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a yeast. I have different cautions about each of these. I'm not just saying they're great for everybody. But the Saccharomyces boulardii can also help to reduce the Clostridium and Candida. We were talking about how we're not feeding the Candida. If you want to further reduce them, Saccharomyces boulardii can be an option for you. And your clients can also get that from water kefir. Actually, there's a supplement outside at Craig's table that has the Bacillus bacteria and the Saccharomyces boulardii. He only had two of them left yesterday. I don't know if he's here today. I haven't seen him. But yeah, it's got like a little yellow lid, and I was checking it out. It looks pretty good. Okay, so some fiber supplements that your clients might be interested in. Inulin, fructooligosaccharides, potato starch. okay, this PHGG is partially hydrolyzed guar gum. And I feel like this is going to become like a prebiotic supplement in the near future. It is really not broken down by small intestinal bacteria. And I feel like this is gonna be a thing that a lot of people are taking. Green banana flour. So you can see why I've been kind of going on about the green bananas and the plantains. They're just a really good source, and they're kind of a whole food source. It feels better to me to eat a couple tablespoons of green banana flour than to have potato starch. That being said, neither of them are likely to raise blood sugar or to feed small intestinal bacteria. And I can use the green banana flour in, like, this is me making a wrap in my dehydrator. so I can use the green banana flour in my dehydrator. I can make wraps, I can make crackers, I can make little energy balls. You know, and it's not that hard to get a few tablespoons of that in. Potato starch, you know, again, I don't want to tell my clients they have to go get green banana flour. So I'm just looking for some options. Right now, potato starch is an option. I feel like as we've cultivated our foods, we've encouraged those sugars that taste sweet and not those sugars that taste like eating an unripe banana. And that's just, and I can't tell people to go eat wild food. They just look at me like I'm crazy. I can't tell everybody to go and get partially hydrolyzed guar gum or green banana flour. So, I mean, Mike said it yesterday, if you haven't got the gut right, keto's not going to work anyway. And you might even have clients who have had gut tests, who have been doing all the right things and still have, you know, like Citrobacter overgrowth. And these people are in pain. I know what it's like to be in pain. It is very coercive. You'll do anything to get out of it. And I implore you to ask yourself, is the worst thing to really tell them to eat some potato starch or green banana flour if you know it's not going to spike their blood sugar? But I really implore you to look at the gut. Look at the gut first. If they're having this overlapping issues and so many things going on, please look at their gut. Get that right. Reduce their inflammation. Help to get them out of pain. And then you're going to get so, so much more leverage out of any of these other dietary interventions that you're working through with them. Okay, so I want to do questions, and I want to talk about like how to make this practical. Because right now I've really just sort of presented a bit of a problem that we need to figure out how to work through with our clients. But if you have any questions or anything at all about this, I would love to talk. And if you don't want to talk right now, we can sit together at lunch and talk. But yeah, any questions? Give me something.
Thanks, Steph. That's a good, really good summary. Okay, I've got to put my hot water down. psyllium husk for using for wraps. That could be an experimental thing. And also, I've had some good results with chia seeds. Not for everyone. And right. It depends on what their microbiome. I use the GI map test as a bit of a diagnostic because looking at the gut can be really difficult just based on symptoms alone.
Yeah.
But yeah, do you have much experience with testing out chia seeds in the evening as a timing, working with the parasympathetic nervous system to be able to calm and soothe without over fermenting?
Yeah, I'm still not a huge fan of nighttime eating.
To clarify, after dinner, so 3 hours before bed.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Sweet. So chia seeds, their resistant starch content is actually not that high. They're a great demulcent, and we're getting all into gray area here. So demulcent, you know how I talked about carbohydrates being water soluble? So you put water on chia, and some of the carbohydrates become so big that we can't, or they're in the water, they're like so big and they're all pushing together. They're like, and that's what makes it thick when you put chia seeds in water. And those can be broken down before they get all the way to where the bifido need to live in the large intestine. Not in everybody. So it's kind of a trial and error situation. And same with a lot of the other demulcent herbs. I love to use chia in my wraps and crackers and everything in the dehydrator. I find chia is pretty accessible, doesn't taste weird. Yeah, that's a good point. Psyllium, I've had... I feel like psyllium is a risky food for people who have had any kind of irritable or inflammatory bowel condition, so I just don't really include it in these kind of things. But yeah, it's another thing to experiment with. Again, the resistant starch content isn't super high, but the fiber is. Let's go to the front row first and then.
Yeah. Sure. Hi, I'm just curious about, I noticed that you had white rice as that on the list, but not brown rice, and I'm wondering if you could speak to the difference between the two.
Yeah, so for the resistant starch content, the white rice is more accessible. The brown rice ends up being more fiber that isn't really resistant starch and doesn't really do this. It doesn't make resistant starch number 3 when you heat and cool it, unfortunately. Yeah, I know. also, brown rice... I mean, it can be it can be with anti-nutrients and with gluten cross-reactions, it can be a bit of a risk food for people too. I don't normally like have rice in any, like a, I don't even talk about rice. I just couldn't come up with anything else. Yeah, thanks.
I'm a complete beginner. I'm just starting on this, but listening to one of your slides, would you recommend that someone maybe begin just eating plantains and green bananas? And if so, how do you prepare them? Would cooking damage that, et cetera?
Okay, yeah, bingo. So for plantains and green bananas that have the resistant starch 2 that can't be retrograded, we can't cook them in order to have this benefit. So one thing that I've done with plantains is I've blended them up in my blender. I added some bifidobacteria. I was in a hotel room, so I literally had nothing else except my blender. I'm normal. It's cool. So I blended up the plantains with water and bifidobacterium and made myself a yogurt. I think it would have tasted a lot better if I had added, you know, some other things to it, maybe a little bit of coconut oil. But it worked okay. And yeah, it tasted fine. It was really actually quite neutral. And I was in the grocery store here the other day, and I saw this lava yogurt that had green banana in it as well. So I think kind of blending it into something, and with your yogurts, you can make them into a parfait or like a fun dip, or that way you can use them for a bunch of different meals. Okay, I got 1 minute.
Is it perfect? I have one.
Okay, and then Lynn, yeah.
Are you cooking the plantain, or are you doing it wrong?
Can't. If you want to have those resistant starches, you can't. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we have some questions from the live stream. How useful is it to make and eat coconut yogurt from initial bifido powder, and should we be rotating those types of bacteria often?
Initial bifido powder, do you mean just like taking it from the jar every time?
Exactly.
You figure? Yeah, that can be good. I actually, the more you take your yogurt and make it into other yogurt with plant-based yogurts, the less potent it becomes. You cannot infinitely make yogurt from yogurt. You can do it, and every time you're going to get less and less and less yield of those helpful bacteria until about 10 times when it starts to taste like not yogurt at all. So taking it straight from the jar is probably the most potent way that you can do it. Was the second half of your question again?
Should we be rotating those types of bacteria often?
So the bifidobacteria, whichever ones you can get, are kind of an essential thing for each of us to just have in our gut. So the lactobacillus that we might rotate make up maybe 1 to 2% of our gut bugs, and the bifidobacteria might make up to 10% of our gut bugs. A lot of us, especially if we have like the FUT2 or different genetic situations, we can't hold on to them very well. So if it's from the bifido family, I don't tend to rotate it. I tend to have that as a staple, to have that as like a preventative and a health maintenance in my yogurt.
I have one more question.
Okay.
All right. What to do for kids with digestive and constipation issues? Is resistant starch recommended, or will it confuse issues?
Can Ching Kwan look at the situation? I do not know. So it depends on the person, honestly. Yeah. I hope that's all right. We'll talk about it later if you'd like. Okay, thank you so much.
Oh.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Awesome.